Good day. Today is Monday, 6 July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me start with a brief announcement. Unfortunately, as has happened in the past, it appears that there have been a number of new AI channels with fabricated versions of myself now appearing on YouTube and apparently also on other platforms. I've actually taken the trouble to watch one and was dismayed to find that the comments that were being made by the simulation of myself were completely in conflict with my known opinions, my actual opinions. Let me take this opportunity to remind everybody again that the only place where you will find me is on this channel, on the Duran, and on certain very well-known channels, YouTube channels, where I am a guest, and the reality of those channels is not really disputable. So in time, I am confident that the YouTube authorities will track down these channels and close them down. Unfortunately, for the moment, as soon as one is closed down, another springs up in its place. There's limited amount that I can do. I know, as I said, that YouTube is busy doing what they can. I'm afraid for the moment this is a reality I have to live by. Deeply frustrating and upsetting though it is. Well, with that, let me now proceed with the substance of this programme, and let me start with news about a further massive attack by the Russians on Kiev. And the attack that the Russians carried out last night was on an enormous scale, bigger than the attack that they carried out 4 days ago. Again, hundreds of Geran drones used. Apparently, all of the Geran drones used in these attacks on Kiev are jet-powered, which makes it all but impossible for the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian air defences, such as they are, to intercept them. The bulk of the missiles used, and some reports put the number of missiles launched against targets in Kiev at around 70 again, but the bulk of them seem to have been either ballistic missiles, Iskander ballistic missiles, or Tsarkon hypersonic missiles. I think it's possible that eventually we will learn that other missiles were used, KH-101s and Kalibr missiles and those sort of missiles. But last night, the big blows were done by ballistic missiles, Iskander-Ms and Tsarkon missiles. Now, a Western defence official a few days ago admitted the truth, the obvious truth, that there is no Western air defence system capable of shooting down the Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missile. There are possibly systems that could shoot down the Kinzhal hypersonic system, which is essentially a ballistic missile air-launched by MiG-31 fighter jets. There are theoretical ways that air defence interceptors like the Patriot missile system might be able to shoot down a Kinzhal. I'm not saying that it's ever happened. The Ukrainians, of course, claim that it has, as has the US defence industry. I've made my own scepticism about this perfectly clear, but I accept that in theory such a thing is possible. It seems that the Patriot system, as is universally acknowledged, cannot shoot down the Tsarkon cruise missile system. Its flight characteristics are completely different from a ballistic missile. Apparently, it retains hypersonic speeds right up to impact. There is no system in the West that can shoot a Tsarkon system down. There have been some suggestions that some of the ship-based American air defense systems, the standard systems carried by the Aegis-class destroyers, might be able to shoot down a Tsarkon system. I don't believe that is the case. There are lots of reasons why. I'm not going to explore that in my program, in this program. Certainly the Ukrainians have no capability to shoot down Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missiles, even though that has not prevented them in the past from claiming that they have. Just saying. Anyway, from what I can understand, even the Ukrainians admit that last night they were not able to shoot down a single ballistic missile or a single Tsarkon missile that hit targets in Kiev. And, well, the pictures of the destruction in and around Kiev, which are all over the internet, speak for themselves. Now, the Russian Defense Ministry has provided us with a description of the attack. They say that it was carried out in response to what the Defense Ministry says were terrorist attacks launched by the Kiev regime against civilian infrastructure on the territory of the Russian Federation. Well, the Russians always say that ahead of every missile strike, big missile strike. But last week, General Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff of the Russian Armed Forces and the overall commander of Russian forces conducting the special military operation, said what I believe is the truth, that all of the big strikes that the Russians are conducting in Ukraine are being conducted in accordance with a plan, an actual plan of the Russian general staff. So there's clearly a plan. That plan is being enacted by the Russian military. I've never myself had the slightest doubts about this. And we shouldn't place too much weight, at least in my opinion, on the fact that, as I said, the Defense Ministry, the Russian Defense Ministry, tells us that these were all retaliatory attacks. And the Russian Defense Ministry says that defense industry, fuel and power facilities in Kiev and the Kiev region, as well as infrastructure of military airfields in Dnipropetrovsk, Poltava, Cherkasy, Chernigov and Kiev regions were also attacked. And then, as the Russian Defense Ministry has recently taken to doing, they provide us with a list of the targets that were attacked in Kiev. The Kiev 71 industrial enterprise, Abris PT Production Association, which they say is one of Ukraine's key enterprises specializing in the development and production of long-range and medium-range reconnaissance drones. And then there's a list of the drones in question. Then the Kiev 1 Electronics Serial Production Plant, also known as the Kiev Burevestnik State Enterprise, which manufactures long-range and medium-range drones. as well as radar equipment for the Ukrainian military. The Kiev 79 industrial enterprise, Ukrarmotech, it is one of the key manufacturers and suppliers of armored vehicles and armored elements for the Ukrainian military, as well as warheads, munitions for different types of missiles and drones. The Kiev shipyard, Kuznia Onrybalsky privately held company, which is the largest mechanical engineering enterprise manufacturing project 581555 Gyurza M artillery boats, as well as producing and repairing strike uncrewed drones. The Kiev 1 instrument engineering plant, the Kvant factory, a key scientific and production base that manufactures fire control systems, electro-optical active protection systems, navigation assets, and automatics for the Ukrainian Air Force and Navy, including for Neptune guided missiles. These are Ukrainian anti-ship missiles. They bear some superficial resemblance to the Russian K-25 anti-ship missile, KH-25 anti-ship missile, and the American Harpoon missile. And by the way, it was Neptune missiles, which are claimed to have destroyed Russia's Moskva cruiser, the biggest warship loss suffered by the Russian Navy in the war by far, back in the early summer of 2022. And then in the Kiev region, we read that the Zhuliani missile unit and component plant, it is a state enterprise that produces, maintains, and repairs anti-aircraft missile systems, aircraft technologies, and air defense components, and long-range fixed-wing drones. As a result of the strike, a repeated large detonation is recorded. Now, the Zhuliani missile unit might also be located on the Zhuliani airfield, which is a well-established location for Ukrainian Patriot missile batteries. And the Vishnevoye depot, which is a key experimental industrial establishment and technical engineering base specializing in the design and maintenance of petrol stations, tank fields, gasoline and diesel stored there, are employed for the emergency delivery of fuel into the combat zone. So the Russians have provided us with a fairly detailed account of the enterprises in Kiev and in the area around Kiev, which they say were attacked. And again, it's clear that what is being targeted mostly is Ukraine's long-range drone facilities and its missile plants. And there's every reason to think that significant destruction was done. If we're talking about attacks with 70 missiles, ballistic missiles and hypersonic missiles, and if we are talking about attacks also carried out by jet-powered Geran drones, then there is every reason to think that the damage done to each and every one of these industrial facilities will indeed have been very extensive. These attacks are on a completely different scale of potency to the attacks done by light drones carrying relatively small warheads of the kind that Ukraine uses mostly in its strikes against Russia. And as I said, we there's lots of footage of fires, smoke, and damage like that across Kiev as a result of this strike. Perhaps the most interesting thing about this strike, or rather the two most interesting things about this strike, is first that the Oreshnik system was again not used. The Russians, as I've discussed in several programs, are now mass producing the Oreshnik system, which has been refined in order to increase its accuracy so as to attack command bunkers in populated centers like Kiev itself. But those attacks on command bunkers in Kiev have not yet begun. I have, by the way, heard eye-watering numbers for the number of Oreshnik missiles that Russia is producing each month. I think it's Stanislav Krapivnik on an open video who has said that, according to his informants, the Russians are producing 25 of these very, very powerful missiles each month. I've heard other reports that suggest that production rates of the Oreshnik are higher still. Of course, there's lots of speculation about the Oreshnik also being used to attack potentially targets in Europe. We'll come to all the war talk between Russia and the West later in this program. But it seems to me that even if the Russians are busy stockpiling Oreshnik missiles for such eventualities, if production numbers of the Oreshnik are anywhere close to the figures that I am hearing, the Russians have more than enough Oreshniks to conduct strikes against command facilities in cities like Kiev and Kharkiv in Ukraine as well. Just say. So, no use of the Oreshnik yet. Possibly, the Russians are still in the process of building a reserve of these missiles. They might want to wait until they have a big enough stockpile before they start using it, so that there is never any possibility that they are short of Oreshnik missiles in case a strike, a crisis begins. But I also suspect that, to go back to that phrase the Russians so often like to use, Russian military so often use, about conducting operations rhythmically, the situation on the ground has not yet evolved to the point where, from a military point of view, the Russians judge using the Oreshnik against command bunkers useful. Using it prematurely would simply give the Ukrainians and their Western sponsors time to adjust and find alternatives before the big blow on the ground lands. You want to time your attack on the command bunkers for maximum effectiveness at precisely the moment when your forces are achieving, presumably, their breakthroughs on the front lines. Just to say. Anyway, so no use of the Oreshnik. So that's one important thing that I took from this strike yesterday. The other was the almost complete failure of Ukraine's air defense. Ukraine did have some Patriot missiles, and there is pictures of interceptor missiles being launched by Ukraine over the course of last night's attack. The missiles almost, well, I think in every case that I've seen, miss the target, and you see them ultimately falling back to Earth. It looks as if Ukraine's air defense system, Kiev's air defense system, arguably the most dense and sophisticated in Europe outside Russia, last night again failed totally. And as I've said, even the Ukrainians themselves acknowledge that not a single ballistic missile or a single Tsarkon missile was shot down over the course of last night. Now, reports have been circulating in Poland that apparently, at the request or maybe the instruction of the German Defense Minister, Boris Pistorius, Poland secretly transferred a number of Patriot missile interceptors to Ukraine. It's not clear to me exactly when that happened, but it appears to have happened this year. And the Polish Parliament was not informed, which apparently violates Poland's constitution and law. So this is all done covertly in a completely secret way. But given that we're talking about the transfer of American-built air defense systems, it seems as if the United States must have been informed. In fact, I'm going to go further. It seems to me that what's clearly happened is that there has been a discussion between the Germans and the Americans over the last few months. The Americans have been explaining to the Germans that there simply aren't air defense missiles to share with Ukraine. The United States, after depleting its anti-air defense missile arsenals catastrophically during the 40-day war with Iran, is now prioritizing rebuilding its own stockpiles. And an agreement was privately reached between the Americans, the Germans, and the Poles that it would be the Poles who would provide the air defense missiles to Ukraine. And because this was known to be an unpopular and controversial move in Poland itself, and one which was likely to provoke opposition in the Polish parliament, the parliament itself was written out of the discussion. Well, there's lots that can be said about this, and I'm going to say some of it later in this program. But we can see the effect. Patriot missile interceptors were supplied to Ukraine. I don't know in what quantity, but last night they failed. Poland has been prevailed upon to deplete its own inventory of rare and difficult to replace Patriot missile interceptors to no useful purpose because the Patriot air defense missile interceptors cannot intercept Russian ballistic and hypersonic missiles. Once again, we see the extent of the West's or of Europe's obsession with trying to help and sustain Ukraine. And once again, we see the fruit of that obsession. Poland's air defence systems have been rendered weaker than they previously were, precisely at a time when the West, Western Europe, is supposed to be rearming. So that's the first thing I wanted to say about this operation. But of course, it's likely that there will be more Russian strikes, on Kiev. I think it's a certainty that the Oreshnik is going to be used. And as last night's attack confirmed, Ukraine has no air defense system that is capable of countering these strikes anymore. The years when Ukraine pretended and could plausibly, at least with some degree of plausibility, pretend that it could defend its capital against Russian missile strikes, those days are coming to an end. Kiev is lying open. So that is one thing. The other thing is, of course, Ukraine itself attempted to carry out its own big drone attack on Russia last night. Apparently, at least 200 drones were used. Some are saying that the number was much greater. Huge numbers of drones launched against Russia by Ukraine. And the Russian Defense Ministry tells us that the attack, the Ukrainian drone attack, was successful. On the night from 5th to 6th July 2026, the Kiev regime attempted to launch a massive attack on the territory of the Russian Federation. 625 long-range drones against facilities outside the special military operation zone. 613 drones were shot down over Russia's regions. The aim of the attack was to demonstrate to sponsors from European countries, including the United Kingdom, the readiness of Ukraine to hit civilian facilities inside Russia from the territory of Ukraine on their money on the eve of the NATO summit meeting in Ankara. And then the Russians provide us a detailed breakdown of the drones that were shot down. And in its totality, they say that the drone attack was unsuccessful. Only a small number of drones managed to avoid being brought down, either being shot down or brought down by electronic jamming systems. And apparently, according to the Russians, little damage was done. The attack, as the Russian Defense Ministry puts it, was repelled. Now, there has been some reports from inside Russia itself, and they do appear to confirm that little damage overall was done by this Ukrainian attack. There was also a Ukrainian attack last night on Crimea, again involving drones. The Crimean authorities switched off the power system over Crimean towns. This may have been some kind of precaution, or perhaps it was intended to prevent disruption of anti-jamming signals by the Russian air defense. But again, it looks as if no significant damage was done. And according to the Russian media, by the morning, the power, the electric power across Crimea had been turned back on. Well, there is still perhaps information to get about the Ukrainian drone attack. Maybe it did more damage than these initial reports say. But however much damage it did, this Russian drone and missile attack, and the one that we had on the 4th, 4 days ago, on the 2nd of July, and the preceding big Russian missile and drone attack on Kiev on the 15th of June, again tell us the basic story. Ukrainian drone attacks are able to do some damage from time to time to Russian facilities. They can sometimes get through and inflict some damage to refineries, for example. But there is simply no comparison in terms of sheer destructive power between these Russian attacks on Kiev and the Ukrainian attacks that we have been hearing and reading so much about. If one takes one's mind back to the big Ukrainian drone strike on Moscow that took place in June, the only strike, by the way, on Moscow that we've had over the last few weeks, some damage was done to certain tanks, fuel tanks in a big refinery. Apparently, some debris from drones fell on some buildings housing indoor markets. But overall, the damage done, as I said at the time, and has now been confirmed to me by many people who've been there, who have been in Kiev, including, by the way, Westerners, the damage was so slight overall as to be essentially invisible. And all the commentators that I've spoken to have specifically refuted the claims about sooty rain and smoke covering the city or anything of that kind. Whereas with the attack on Kiev, we have seen major attacks and undoubtedly significant destruction of important industrial plants and, of course, the really big system. The Oreshnik has not been used so far. Now, there's been a lot of narrative over the last few months about Kiev having regained the initiative in the drone war, in the war in the sky. If we're talking about long-range drones, the comparison of the effectiveness of Russian strikes with Ukrainian strikes tells a completely different story. Anyway, that's this big drone missile strike. NATO is about to convene its summit meeting in Ankara tomorrow. President Trump is said to be already on his way. There's been much commentary and claim that the Russian missile and drone strike on Kiev was intended to coincide with the start of the NATO summit meeting. I think there may be some truth to that, but overall, my own sense is that the general staff, it's the general staff that dictates the timing of strikes, and I don't think they pay very much attention to political meetings in the West and their timing. That's my own view. As I said, I know many, many people will disagree. But anyway, Zelensky is apparently intending to go to Ankara, and he's going to plead for more money and more air defense. In fact, he's already doing that at the moment. But of course, what he's mostly going to be doing whilst he is in Ankara is engaging in more narrative control and actually narrative protection. Because two things have happened over the last week which contradict the narrative that he has been trying to promote. The first is the fall of Konstantinovka, which goes against his narrative of a stalled Russian offensive on the front lines. That is one. And the second is two big Russian drone and missile strikes on Kiev, doing real damage that contradict his other narrative that Ukraine now has wrested back the initiative in the sky, in the war in the sky. So this, in theory, should be a challenge, except I don't think it will be, because far too many people in the West, important people in the West, have now become so invested in Zelensky's narratives that they find it impossible to push back against them. So I have yet to see in the British media today a single article that makes the comparison I spoke about, comparing the scale and effectiveness of the Russian strike on Kiev, the two recent Russian strikes on Kiev, the one that happened last night and the one that happened 4 days ago, and the Ukrainian strike on Moscow. I haven't seen a single article that compares the one to the other. And of course, if we're talking about Konstantinovka, the denials just keep coming. Zelensky says that Konstantinovka has not fallen. The General Staff of Ukraine say Konstantinovka has not fallen. Entirely predictably, we've had pictures published by the Ukrainians of Ukrainian soldiers raising flags in central Konstantinovka and in one other part of Konstantinovka, again purporting to show Ukrainian control of Konstantinovka. Of course, we've had lots of many more photos and films of Russian soldiers in essentially the same places, doing the same thing, raising flags, implying a degree of Russian control. I think actually complete Russian control. Logically, the right thing to do for a Western media outlet blessed with resources far greater than those we possess on the Duran, looking at these Ukrainian pictures and comparing them with these Russian pictures, is to engage in a little investigative journalism, such as I remember used to happen in the old days during the Vietnam War, for example. Going to Konstantinovka or as close to Konstantinovka as possible, finding out what is really going on there. And I'm going to express my opinion. And of course, let me repeat, I am not on the ground, but I personally have no doubt at all that Konstantinovka is indeed under Russian control. There's been a long, long history, the Ukrainians denying reports from the Russians about the capture of towns and cities. And there's been a long, long pattern of the Ukrainians after the Russians announced the capture of cities, of the Ukrainians releasing film footage of their soldiers raising flags in the cities which the Russians say they have captured. On at least two occasions that I know of, this was done. The footage of the Ukrainian soldiers raising those flags were made before the Russians captured the position where the flag raising was done. It was obviously done, in fact, with the intention of releasing the footage after the city, the town, the village had been captured, in order to cast doubt on the Russian claim. And, well, others also have been making the point that even the Russians admit that there are still Ukrainian soldiers in Konstantinovka, though that does not detract from overall Russian control of the town. Gerasimov told Putin this very thing when he informed Putin that Konstantinovka had indeed been captured. He said that there are still clearing operations to do in Konstantinovka before the town is totally cleared of all Ukrainian presence. So it may be that these soldiers who've just raised these flags in Konstantinovka are some of those Ukrainian troops who are still in the town, special forces troops probably, brave souls who obviously for whatever reason are prepared to carry out these orders, even though it puts them in extreme danger, I would guess, to do it. Anyway, I'm not going to explore this further. All I will say is I have absolutely no doubt at all that Konstantinovka has indeed fallen. Now, yesterday the Russians made two further claims. They said that they were prepared to agree a two-hour ceasefire in the area of Konstantinovka so that they could hand over to the Ukrainians the bodies of the Ukrainian soldiers who had died and fallen defending Konstantinovka. And as I expected, and as I'm sure the Russians expected, the Ukrainians rejected that offer. Now, the Russians are also saying, and I stress it is the Russians, that 13,500 Ukrainian troops or thereabouts died in the battle for Konstantinovka. I have stopped placing very much weight on the claims either side makes about the casualties that they say they have inflicted on the other in any one particular place or indeed in the war at all. I think that both sides inflate the losses that they're inflicting on the other side, and for all I know, they may be minimizing their own losses. Certainly in the case of the Ukrainians, I have no doubt that they are. So I am not going to run with this claim that 13,500 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in Konstantinovka. I'm not saying it is untrue. I'm saying that I don't know that it is true, and I've explained my own reasons for doubt. The one thing I would say is that if the Russians have indeed collected all the dead bodies, then they presumably also counted them And that might point towards some validity to this number. I remember that after the fall of Bakhmut, Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner organization that captured Bakhmut in the early summer of 2023, he did exactly that. He had apparently taken it, made a very, very careful record of all of the bodies, Ukrainian and Russian bodies, that his forces found in Bakhmut. And it seems that he did provide actually very accurate figures for the number of losses, the horrendously high losses both sides had suffered in the Bakhmut battle. Well, perhaps this time the Russian Defense Ministry has indeed taken a leaf from Prigozhin's book, in which case perhaps we ought to believe this figure of 13,500 men, in which case all I would say is that Ukrainian losses defending Konstantinovka have been horrendous, far more than I would have thought was worthwhile by any objective reading of the overall situation in the war. Anyway, let me repeat again the various caveats and conditions that I've said. I am not saying that this number is true. I'm just saying that there are possible reasons why it might be true. Anyway, let's move on. So that's the situation in Konstantinovka. There continues to be lots of fighting elsewhere on the front lines. Now, in that meeting with Putin that took place a couple of days ago, where Gerasimov informed Putin that Konstantinovka had fallen, Gerasimov also mentioned that there is street fighting going on within Orekhov and that the Russians control roughly a third of the town. This is in Zaporozhye region. And certainly there is a lot of fighting going on around Orekhov. And as I've discussed in recent programs, the Russian forces from the east are edging closer and closer to the main supply roads supplying the Ukrainian garrison in Orekhov and threatening to cut it off from resupply. I am more skeptical of Gerasimov's claims that fighting is taking place in Orekhov. What I would say is that some months ago, back last year, Gerasimov also claimed in a briefing with Putin that street fighting was taking place in the northern Donbass town of Siversk. And though that might not have been true when Gerasimov said it nonetheless happened that Siversk did fall soon after. So Gerasimov's claim that there is fighting going on in Orekhov might be, as we say in the West, in Britain, gilding the lily, making things look better than they are. But clearly, it should also be read as a pointer that Orekhov is indeed a Russian objective and will soon fall. Now, about another place, I don't think there's any doubt at all. There's been more video footage from Liman, all of which appears to confirm that every part of Liman is under Russian control. I suspect that the Russians are holding back the announcement of Lehman's capture for the NATO summit meeting in Ankara. They intend to gate crash NATO's party by announcing Lehman's capture whilst the NATO summit is underway. And lastly, and this is a brief summary, it looks as if Ukrainian defences in northern Kharkiv, around the small town of Belykolodis, the Ukrainian defences there are disintegrating. There's apparently map changes put together by the various mapping projects, which show Belykolodis now taken into a semicircle by Russian forces advancing towards it from the west and the north. The supply lines to Belykolodis look to me as if they've been essentially cut. It looks as if this town is being stormed, and no doubt the Russians will announce its capture very soon. Anyway, that's the situation in the war. The Russians continue to grind Ukraine down. They continue to advance in Donbass. They continue to say that the war is going in their favour. But alongside that, we are now starting to get more reasons for thinking that there is going to be an escalation of some kind from the Russian side. And what makes me think this is an extremely interesting interview that Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov gave to Pavel Zarubin on Vesti. And Peskov said this: there is a war going on. This is a real war. It all started as a special military operation. It continues like a war because Berlin, Paris, The Hague, Oslo, and unfortunately Washington are behind Kiev. Because they are being helped to arm, to aim through their satellites, they're being helped to aim foreign weapons at our targets through their entire infrastructure. So, Peskov, up to now, has always seemed to me to be Putin's very faithful mouthpiece. I cannot recall a situation where Peskov says something with which Putin either doesn't agree or himself would not say. But now we have Peskov saying this: this is a special military operation. In other words, it is conducted within a certain restricted legal framework. But the West, the Western powers, through the way in which they have been assisting Ukraine, through the way in which they have been helping Ukraine to conduct deep strikes into Russia using their satellites, using, in other words, the Starlink system, that they have converted the special military operation into what Peskov calls a real war. Now, this is the second time in a week that Peskov has departed from Putin's established policy. It was, after all, Putin who said that the conflict in Ukraine should be conducted as a special military operation, not as a war. Peskov is now saying, Putin's spokesman is now saying, that this terminology is obsolete. Putin has also in the past, several times in the past, and it's there in the April 2022 Istanbul Agreement, Putin has said that though Russia strongly objects to Ukraine entering NATO, which is a military alliance, Russia does not object to Ukraine joining the European Union, which is a trade association. Now, a couple of days ago, as I discussed on a program on this channel, Peskov departed from that. He said that the European Union has transformed itself into a political, military, and industrial organization which is hostile to Russia. He did not say that the Russians now object to Ukraine joining it, though the implication obviously is there. But he did say that this transformation of the European Union means that the Russians are soon going to have to adjust their policies. I have said in many programs that since the Valdai attack in December 2025, the Russians have been engaged in a very complex, very lengthy discussion of where the war is going and how they should continue with the war and what their approach should be in light of the failure of the negotiations with the Americans, which took place last year, and in light also of the Valdai attack, which the Russians construe as an assassination attempt on Putin, in which they believe the Americans were involved. And, well, I think we're now starting to see the products of that discussion. Peskov joining other Russian officials, Medvedev, Lavrov, Shoigu, saying that the European Union is no longer just a trade association. It is a military alliance and should, which is hostile to Russia and should be construed in that way. And Peskov now coming forward and saying this is no longer a special military operation. This is a war. An actual war being conducted against us by the West. Not just Ukraine, not just the Europeans, but also the United States as well. He specifically, in fact, refers to the United States. He speaks of it continues like a war, because Berlin, Paris, The Hague, Oslo, and unfortunately Washington are behind Kiev. So, here again is my own view. I still don't think that Putin feels that the situation justifies escalating the war in the way that some people, especially in the West, want to see happen. Oreshnik missile strikes against European targets, for example, and things of that kind. I don't think the decision to do any of these things has been made in Moscow. I think that the Russians have made decisions in the past following Western missile attacks, or rather missile attacks on their own country, facilitated by the West, using ATACMS and Storm Shadow missiles. The Russians made a decision long ago that, in light of that, they would provide military assistance to Western adversaries, like Iran specifically, and by the way, North Korea too, just to say. And I think we've seen the fruits of that assistance from the Russians to these countries manifest themselves, and in the Persian Gulf, manifested themselves very obviously during the recent 40-day war there. And I think the Russians have also made a decision. Putin says they have made a decision that if missiles and drones are actually launched against their country from NATO territory, then Russia will attack the launch sites. And Putin has said this, and I'm sure that decision has also been made. But I don't think that the Russians, if the situation remains at the level where it is, feel that they need to conduct strikes into Europe itself, let alone the United States. The Ukrainian drone strikes and the various missile strikes are nowhere near effective for that to be done, and for the Russians to embrace the kind of risks that would follow that type of counter-escalation. But I do think that the Russians are very close to doing two things which will indeed change the dynamic of the war. The first, obviously, is to announce formally that they no longer support Ukraine's membership of the EU. On the contrary, they oppose it. I don't know whether the Russians have already communicated this to the Europeans, to President Costa's envoys, for example. They might have done. But if they haven't, I expect some kind of announcement to this effect from Moscow over the next few weeks or months. The second is that the Russians might very well soon upgrade the special military operation. And I've discussed this several times in the past. One possibility is that they could upgrade it into an out-and-out war between themselves and Ukraine. Or they might fall just short of that by upgrading it to an anti-terrorist operation. In which case, that would give the Russians, or rather the Russian military, the green light, the legal basis to come and strike not just the military and intelligence decision-making centers in Kiev, but the political ones as well. In other words, they might start hunting and eventually killing, assuming they catch up with him, Zelensky itself, but perhaps also the various Western military officials in Kiev that are known to be taking an extremely active role in Ukraine's war effort. I personally believe that these upgrades are all but inevitable. And if they do happen, they will change the course of the war. Peskov's comments about satellites are a case in point. The Russians, during the January protests in Iran, showed that they do have a capability to jam the Starlink system. I wonder whether they've held back from doing that for legal reasons, because this is still only a special military operation, or whether the Russians are now thinking of upgrading the special military operation to an anti-terrorist operation, in which case that might give them legal authority, as they see it, under their own laws, to start acting against the Starlink system, attacking the Starlink system itself. And of course, one can come up with other possibilities, some kind of mobilization in Russia. I still think myself that that is extremely unlikely. It doesn't seem to me as if the Russians are short of troops on the conflict lines, just to say. But the Russians, if they do upgrade the SMO into an anti-terrorism operation, an ATO, I mean, that would also obviously give them the green light to take much more active steps in the dirty war. Again, Peskov's statements, the one about the European Union becoming a military alliance, and his latest one about potential strikes on Europe, and about the fact that what we see is the SMO becoming a war as a result of direct European intervention. What we see from Peskov strongly suggests to me that these decisions are very soon going to be made. Well, all of this is very pertinent to the next thing I'm going to speak about, which is a brilliant article published by the former British naval officer, Steve Jeremy. Steve Jeremy, of course, was not just a naval officer. He rose to the rank of commander. So he's somebody with a very senior position in the British defence establishment. And he's also, obviously, a keen student of naval affairs. And he is someone, by the way, that I have interviewed and met and was very impressed by and very much liked. Anyway, Steve Germany has now written a very disturbing article, The Coming War with Russia, A European Road to Ruin. And it's published on the Substack site of Mor Galos, Using Power Wisely in the 21st Century. Anyway, Steve Jeremy looks at Western rearmament plans, or to be more precise, European rearmament plans, and he finds them gravely lacking. He also says that this constant cycle of extreme provocation against the Russians that some European leaders are indulging in is almost calculated to provoke the Russians into a potential military response. And Steve Jeremy makes the point that from the Western side, This is incredibly unwise, because the military build-up that the European members of NATO are engaging in, indulging in, is going to come nowhere close to putting the European members of NATO in a position where they could go head-to-head with the Russians in a conventional war. And Steve Jeremy gives his own account of how such a war might develop. Attempts by the European members of NATO to establish some kind of no-fly zone over Ukraine. The European Air Forces very quickly encountering the by now extremely layered and very sophisticated and very experienced Russian air defence system. European fighter jets getting shot down in large numbers and operations becoming repelled, being repelled. The Russians on their part conducting counter-strikes using hypersonic missiles against Western ports, airfields, railway lines, roadways, bunker complexes, you name it. The Russians have the weapons with the Oreshnik and the other weapons to do all of these things. The United States getting cold feet and pulling out. The Europeans being left on their own, unable to break what would in effect be a sea blockade of Europe by the Russian Navy. The Europeans forced to capitulate. The European economy collapsing. The political system in Europe also collapsing. Altogether, Steve Jeremy describes an absolutely cataclysmic picture. And remember, we're talking about a very senior naval officer in Britain. A commodore, for example, outranks a captain. Well, you may think all this alarmist, but I don't. I've seen the balance of military power shift in favour of the Russians ever since the SMO began. This latest folly of Poland handing over its air defence missiles to Ukraine so that Ukraine can just squander them is a further case in point of the folly built upon folly, which has been our entire policy. I am not a military person. Maybe I shouldn't comment on his description of how a war between Russia and Europe, which did not go nuclear, would probably play out. I'm not going to comment or dispute any of that. I can easily imagine that Steve Jeremy is right, and that we would indeed, in that case, get a convincing, even overwhelming, Russian victory. But for the record, I myself continue to be of the view that even if the Americans got cold feet and pulled out, the risk of nuclear weapons use is so extremely high that I think the Russians would be extremely reluctant to go down along this path. Anyway, having said this, it's these nightmare scenarios of a European war which the members of NATO might catastrophically lose, leading, by the way, directly to a catastrophic military, economic and financial and political collapse. It's all of these things that do make me further agree with another point that Steve Jeremy makes, which is that given the enormous power imbalance and the doubts about the Americans, isn't it time that we put all pride and vanity to one side put Project Ukraine to one side also and began serious discussions with the Russians to de-escalate the crisis and avoid the drift to war? Well, it's a rhetorical question because, of course, I know the answer. The answer is that the European leadership is going to continue exactly in the same way as it always has. And, well, if we continue to do that, the possibility that we might end up in a scenario not completely different from the one that Steve Jeremy outlines, it seems to me, is indeed a very real one. Well, you would have thought that at the summit meeting of the NATO states in Ankara, they would all be talking about that. But it seems not. President Trump, perhaps somewhat nonplussed by Putin's categorical refusal to make any concessions in the telephone call they had on the 4th of July, is now coming forward apparently and says that he wants to meet with Zelensky in Ankara, and that after that meeting he's going to call Putin and see whether he's going to be able this time to get some kind of progress towards negotiations. I predict that if he tells Zelensky to pull his troops out of Donbass, which would be very good advice, by the way, Zelensky will pay no attention. And anything short of that is not going to cut any ice in Moscow, just to say. But anyway, Trump perhaps intends to try. But in all other respects, the NATO summit meeting is opening with a picture of recrimination and disagreement greater than I have ever seen it in all the many NATO summit meetings that I have covered or seen. Trump comes to the meeting in a furious mood, very angry about what he sees as European failure to come to the aid of the United States during the fight, the recent fight with Iran. The Europeans divided amongst themselves about the extent of the continued support that should be extended to Ukraine. It seems the doubters are growing, but the big countries, Germany, France, and Britain, remain adamant that the war must continue. And of course, they continue to get support from the Scandinavians and the Baltic states in this uncompromising stance. So, anyway, that's what's going to happen in Ankara. And of course, Zelensky is going to get what he wants, the backing from the major European powers, even as he continues to reject or compromise, bringing the whole discussion essentially back to a stop. So, if Trump does indeed decide to call Putin, he will come again completely empty-handed, and Putin will listen politely, ignore what he says, and the war will go on. Anyway, that, it seems to me, is far and away the most likely scenario. But of course, as the war goes on and as things get worse for Ukraine, the pressure, especially amongst the big three European powers, to escalate is going to increase. and of course the possibility that we're going to end up in the kind of scenarios that Steve Jeremy is talking about. That possibility, in that case, is likely to grow. I would invite anybody who has any influence in Europe to read Steve Jeremy's article and to see how he describes a future war between Europe and Russia. Even if the ultimate calamity of nuclear weapons is avoided, the outcome can only be extremely bad. Why do we persist on inviting it to ourselves? Zelensky, as I said in my previous program, is coming for more money. He's now demanding 70 billion euros, I believe, not dollars or pounds. In my program yesterday, I made the point that back in December, the Europeans agreed to float a 90 billion euro loan to finance Ukraine. I always said that I doubted that they would be able to float the loan. And I also doubted that the money would be enough to keep Ukraine going for the 2 years it was meant to. In my program yesterday, I thought that the 70 billion euros that is now going to be offered to Zelensky is additional to the 90 billion euro loan. It seems more accurate to say that it is the recasting of that loan. The Europeans understand that there would be no interest in the financial markets in buying the bonds that would be required, that would be issued to fund this 90 billion euro loan. So what the Europeans are now doing, as I always said they would, is that they're converting the loan into one that would be floated on the international financial markets into a straight loan between Ukraine and the European states, in which the Europeans, in effect, provide direct financial funding for Ukraine. So they're going to give, at the expense of their taxpayers, another 70 billion euros to Zelensky. The burning up of the Polish missiles is apparently not enough. This lesson, it seems to me, is never going to be learned. I think that even though the Kremlin looks likely to upgrade the SMO before long, I think the line that they do not want to expand the war beyond Ukrainian territory will still just about hold. But the Europeans are certainly pushing the boundaries. They're playing an unbelievably reckless and dangerous game. And the risks of disaster for Europe are just getting greater and greater. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.